This is Peace Talks, the radio series on peacemaking and nonviolent solutions to conflict. I'm Carol Boss. Today on Peace Talks, we'll hear about the Great Law of Peace, which is the founding constitution of the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy. Also known as the Haudenosaunee, the Confederacy, according to oral tradition, came together in ancient times through the efforts of the one who came to be known as the peacemaker. We'll be hearing the story of the peacemaker today from Orin Lyons, faith keeper of the Turtle Clan of the Onondaga Nation of the Haudenosaunee. Lyons, a professor of American Studies at the State University of New York at Buffalo, will tell us more about the principles of the Great Law of Peace. In addition, we'll be featuring comments from John Mohawk of the Seneca Nation, also a professor at Buffalo. He's been active in diplomatic circles for the Seneca Nation for years, as well as being a farmer, writer, and magazine editor. John Mohawk will expand on the peace principles and talk about how they could be applied by individuals and other nations to help create a more peaceful world today. Both of our guests were recorded at the State University of New York at Buffalo. This is Orin Lyons with the story of Peacemaker.
The Peacemaker was a spiritual messenger, came to our people some thousand years ago. We're not certain. We don't have a precise date for that, but it's very old, long before our brother came to us across the sea. And he came into warring nations. The Mohawks, Oneidas, Onondagas, Cayugas, and Senecas were battling not only one another, but internally as well. It was a very, very chaotic state of affairs the time that he came here to bring us peace. Now, he has a long story about his birth and how he was brought up and how he came across the great Ontario Lake in a stone white canoe and first visited the Mohawks. And he had to convince the Mohawks of his abilities and who he was, and he did bring them around to using their common sense and their good minds, which was a great feat. Then they collectively took the leaders from them, and they went to visit the Oneidas, and the same thing happened. Came to the Onondagas, and a very powerful leader by the name of Tododaho did not allow them to penetrate, and so they went around and went to the Cayugas, and the people of the swamp, and then finally over to the Senecas.
Lyons says the Senecas were at first difficult to convince of the peaceful path, but the tribe eventually came on board. The peacemaker then turned to his toughest challenge, going back to try and win over the menacing leader of the Onondagas, Tododaho.
Tododaho, the leader, a very evil man, very twisted and a cannibal and just about all the bad things that you can think of, very powerful as well. But they got to him with the help of a woman who he had met on the first night of his landfall in Mohawk country, and her name was Jagunsasa. She was from the Cat Nation, Erie, and she had a lodge. And so her practice was to feed the men who were on the warpath. They would stay overnight at her lodge, and they would eat. And she had a rule of law that no fighting, leave your weapons outside. So it was natural for her to embrace this stranger coming to her, and he talked to her about what he was doing. She thought that was a wonderful idea, and she was very supportive of it. And he went on to do what he was doing. Now he sent back for her because he said they were having such a problem with Tododaho. They could not penetrate. And she came back with a song. She says, "I have a song." She taught this song to the men, and they approached the Tododaho singing. And they said he was very deformed, almost not recognizable as a human, and even his hair was writhing with snakes. And he came out of the swamp, and they could see the snakes falling from his head as they approached him, and he was transforming. But still he was not convinced, and finally they agreed that if he would join their confederation of peace, then the central fire would be at Onondaga, and all heretofore leaders, the primary leader, would be coming from Onondaga and would carry his name as a title.
It's a tradition that continues to this day. The peace chief now carrying the title Tathadaho is a man named Sidney Hill, who still travels among the nations of the Iroquois to settle disputes and keep the peace, trying to practice what the peacemaker preached to the leaders of the nations so long ago on the southeast shore of Onondaga Lake, known as the Great Law of Peace. Again, Orrin Lyons.
First principle, peace. Second principle, equity, justice for the people. And third, the power of the good minds, of the collective powers to be of one mind, unity and health. All of these things were involved in his basic principles. And the process of discussion and putting aside warfare as a method of reaching decisions, and now using intellect. And he laid down a very precise process for our governance, and which is, of course, basic, is that it is the people's will and it is their agreement to government. They are the ones that will consent to government by consent. And he established two houses, and the two houses, the elder brothers and the younger brothers, Mohawks, Onondagas, Senecas were the elder brothers, Cayugas and Oneidas were the younger brothers, and later on, around 1713, 1721, the Tuscarora Nation joined and joined with the younger brothers. So a process was established of discussion and consensus.
And bearing in mind the key role that the woman Teguntsesa had played in winning the peace, the peacemaker, right from the beginning, made women powerful players in the politics of the Indian nation.
He gave the women the responsibility to choose all leaders and to oversee their conduct, and they had the power of recall. So that was an enormous responsibility for the women, but I think it was a genius that has us still existing today, that process still being used, and the abilities of women to choose a different style of leader. Then he gave, he planted a great symbol called the Great Tree of Peace, which is the white pine. And he illustrated that this pine had four white roots of truth that reach in the four cardinal directions of the earth. And those people who had no place to go could come and follow the route back to its source and come under the shelter of the Great Law of Peace. He established the idea of disarmament when he then uprooted this great tree, and he commanded the men to come forward and throw their weapons of war into this hole. And they did. And then he replaced a tree on top. So often in a depiction of the Great Tree of Peace, you will see a war club or arrows, a bow and arrows, or a hatchet underneath it. And that is where this term, burying the hatchet, comes from.
John Mohawk says that many Indian tribes in North America have explored the nonviolent path when faced with a threat.
You can find the tradition of peacemaking among Native peoples in North America, in the woodlands and across through the northern Great Plains. You'll hear this theme over and over again. The Haudenosaunee, I think, are best known for it because they probably did the most to develop a whole range of strategies and institutions that are very well known. In the 17th and 18th centuries was the most influential, because it was the thing that the Americans, at the very beginning of the American Republic, were most familiar with.
It was at a meeting in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in 1744, when an Onondaga chief stood and chided the governors that were arguing amongst themselves, governor of New York, Pennsylvania, governor of Delaware and Virginia, I believe, were arguing amongst themselves over land, and he stood there and he said to them, you know, he says, you'll never amount to anything until you learn how to sit in council together in a peaceful way. And make a union like ours, he said. Look how powerful we are. Look how old we are. And look how strong we are, because we come with this idea of union based on peace. And those words were written down by Cadwalder Colden, who was an interpreter and also took a lot of notes all during those times. And he's published some books in those times and great reading. But anyway, those notes were taken to Philadelphia, and the publisher of that particular book that was made from those meetings there in Lancaster was none other than Ben Franklin. And Ben Franklin responded to that instruction. So it's a good idea. The eve of the revolution, Continental Congress sent a delegation to the Haudenosaunee and asked them to join them in a coming battle. And the Haudenosaunee responded saying, we know your father. We have good relations with your father. And we know you, and we have good relations with you as well. We see this as a battle between father and son. And we would rather not partake. We think this is something you have to settle between yourselves. And they responded by saying, good, because that was our second request. If you are not going to fight with us, then don't fight against us.
According to John Mohawk, most of the basic principles of peacemaking practiced among Indian nations hundreds of years ago are still essential to effective peacemaking today, including the concept of a safe haven for peace talks.
You have to have that. The people who are going to talk about peace have to know they won't be assassinated on the way to or from the conversation. And so Onondaga, they guaranteed it. They said, if you come here, you'll be safe. And so they devised ways of talking about this. But the first requirement that was on the books was that first you have to do no harm, almost like how doctors are supposed to not do any harm. The diplomats required that the warriors who came to talk about peace first stop killing people while we're talking. And then the idea was, as long as we're talking, nobody's killing anybody. So there was a kind of idea of facilitating what you would call truces. Now, the people on the other sides of the conflict often didn't have any leadership. There was no single person or group on the other side of some of these wars that could end the war. So you had to bring them all, if you could, or as many of them as you could. The council proceedings was aimed as much at the population that was hostile as it was at the warriors and the leaders of the warriors. It was aimed at the people behind them. They had to have people who were supplying them. They had to have support. They had to have cheering when they got home. They had to have a feeling that they were solid and doing the right thing. And the council conversations were often designed to lessen support for the violence in the villages that the perpetrators came from. So it was a very complicated thing. It's a very complicated thing to try to get to people who don't accept any authority. They simply don't accept authority. Individual warriors could get up in the morning and drive a hatchet into a post in someplace in the Ohio Valley or far away and urge. He'd come to the middle of the village and drive his hatchet into the post, and he would announce to the rest of the village, I am forming a war party. Everybody who's forming one with me, put your hatchet under my hatchet. And then he'd call a meeting with them, and they'd go raid somebody. So the village knew, and they picked a leader. He offered himself as a leader, and he was going to lead the war effort or the raid or whatever it was. That was the kind of deal. It was small, cellular, often no way to predict it, no way to address it. So this is what the Six Nations offered. There would always be some place to address that. Somebody could come walking out of the forest and into Onondaga and say, I come from the Miamis. Didn't have to be a Miami war chief, but at least he could take a message back that they would offer to hear what was the grievance. The rules are real complicated. I don't want to reduce these to simplicity. There's a kind of thing of all we have to do is hold hands and sing songs and we'll have peace. Wasn't like that.
Fairness is always the underlying quality. That's what John was talking about. And he said if the person that is bringing the grievance is assured of being heard and being understood fairly, then they will try. Everybody will try if they know that the whole process is designated to solving the problem rather than having one side or the other win. So I think that that is fundamentally important in terms of solving these international problems. You have to have, what I would say, probably could establish a World Council of Elders, such as Mandela and the Dalai Lama and people of that nature. Certainly they could offer a different perspective than if you would have a council of warriors.
You're listening to Peace Talks, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. You can hear all the programs in our series online at peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com. I'm Carol Boss, and today we're hearing from John Mohawk and Orrin Lyons, professors at the State University of New York at Buffalo, both a Haudenosaunee, also known as the Iroquois, acknowledged throughout history as a people with a strong and effective peacemaking tradition. Once again, John Mohawk.
Organized armed aggression, otherwise war, has often motivated societies to organize, to do something to provide for the safety of its people. In this case of the Haudenosaunee, there were two things that were going on. There was organized armed aggression, and there was the internalized chaos of what we could call blood feuding or civil war. Both things were happening at various moments. Most of the time when societies respond to these, they respond to them by organizing their own form of force. So they meet force with force. So the usual thing is to find a way to raise an army and to expel the invaders or to bring some form of control. But I want to point out that the Haudenosaunee, instead of emphasizing the organization of force to meet force, it built its culture around the idea of organizing for peace, organizing for some method of response other than force.
Peace is not passive.
Orrin Lyons.
Peace is very, very dynamic, and it requires a whole lot of effort. It's so easy to just strike out in anger. It's very difficult to control yourself and to find another way to vent. And that's what we face, and that's how we have to deal with it. And right now, all I see is the force that John is talking about, and people always underestimate the will of a people. So I think that the idea of peacemaking is a very old one here, but it's also very complex because of the divergence of thinking, the Western idea, the Western thought. I think what's done very well by a woman who wrote a law treatment, and that was Mary Christina Wood in the Oregon Law Review. She wrote this in 1944, and it's called The Politics of Abundance and the Politics of Scarcity. And that is, I think she encapsulated in this discussion very clearly the problem that we had. Politics of abundance for Indians was to always be respectful of the natural world and to have ceremonies and to make sure that the next generations were taken care of. Indeed, the peacemaker said to our leaders that every decision we make must regard the seventh generation coming. And we shouldn't think of ourselves nor of our family nor even our generation, but make our decision on behalf of seven generations. And most Indian nations that I know, and I know most of them, all have the same respect and reverence for life and for the future and responsibility. So that was a politics of abundance. Politics of scarcity comes from our brothers, and I think Ms. Woods really illustrated that very well, which is to say when things get scarce, then they make rules and they make laws and they make things scarce. I mean, when they're, you know, the salmon discussion that she illustrates about when there were just abundance beyond comprehension of so many salmon coming up on so many rivers and the Willamette and just all these great rivers just full of salmon. And today it's hard to find them there. That's the politics of scarcity. That is the idea of taking more than you need and taking at the expense of your grandchildren.
John Mohawk thinks that many Indian nations, which have had a high respect for peace, have long known what it takes to address conflict within communities and from without. Many nations had a peace chief as well as a war chief that held equal sway in responding to conflict scenarios.
For the most part, when people are at war, they have a grievance. They feel that they're being mistreated, that justice is not their thing. So the principle of the great peace is that justice in the end has to prevail. But everybody knows that people aren't satisfied with justice. They'll get justice today, and then tomorrow their demands will go up. So they also knew that the process of dealing with people was ongoing. You didn't get a closure and then go home. You got somewhere, and then you had a process by which you talked about the next layer of things that are causing conflict. So things must have been pretty busy at Onondaga, and people had to be pretty good at remembering what it was that different groups had come with as their complaints and what had been agreed upon before. Because the protocol was to remind people what it was that we had done up until now. It was an ongoing, continuous scoreboard of here's where we are today. This idea, I think, is really very relevant today, because if you go to Washington or you go to London or anywhere, world leaders today don't have a plan about how to address the violence of chaos. They haven't a clue. What the plan was to go to some place and beat the army. Okay, you went there, you beat their army, but you didn't get the result you were hoping for. Nobody stepped forward and surrendered their sword, and the country itself didn't surrender. What you got was you just beat up their army. And that was not dissimilar, really, to ways of thinking about it. No modern nation state has ever been able to hold out against an insurrection in the face of chaos. When a society collapses and you have guerrilla warriors and different competing groups inside there, you have a civil war going on their side, and the one thing that they're unified is to get rid of the invader. It's practically the only unified thing. But once they get rid of the invader, they'll be perfectly happy to kill one another. That's the secondary thing. In a chaos like that, there's no agreed upon method. How do you respond to it? The answer has been you use more force and more force and more force till you get to the point where you cannot apply any more force. You don't have any more force. You've maxed out. But the chaos is still happening in this. I say that the Six Nations Confederacy under the Great Law actually was born in that kind of environment and devised ways to address that kind of environment. But there's a trick. The people who are going to manage that, if you're going to stand forward and say, okay, I'm going to lead the way out of that jungle, those people can never lie. They have to be completely honorable all the time. They can't take sides. They have to be neutral. They have to be peacemakers. Peacemakers aren't people with an agenda. They don't come to your country to take your forest. They don't come there to kill your buffaloes. They're there to end the violence. That's all. So they have to be completely honorable, completely honest. And that's what I think the Six Nations Confederacy had as its thing. It was a culture, actually. The culture that was around the council was a culture of people who were dedicated to pursuing peace.
It was a matriarchal tilt of the Iroquois Confederacy, says Orrin Lyons, that played a big part in seeking out the leaders that would make pursuing peace a priority.
That was the work of the clan mother. That was the work of the women in choosing the leaders. All her choices had to be ratified by consensus. So even though she made a choice, it had to be agreed upon by either by the clan, by the Council of Chiefs, and finally by the whole Grand Council of Six Nations. This person is vetted all the way. But what is important is that the woman who made the choice is looking for qualities that are different from a war leader. She's looking for qualities that are different from your average president today. As you notice in the history of the United States, many of the presidents have been generals in the armies and so forth. And so you put a general in charge, you're going to get a man of war. I mean, what else is there? Some have risen above that. Eisenhower had some wonderful ideas about fairness and so forth, but that's not really the norm. So I would say that in choosing leaders then, that there has to be the process, and that was the genius of the process that the peacemaker brought and the responsibility of women in not only raising leaders but removing them as well.
Some final thoughts from John Mohawk.
Violence has to have some source. Now, I know people are going to come back next to them. No, it doesn't. Some people are just naturally violent. They're all psychotic and blah, blah, blah. Okay? The problem with that is that if people are really just psychotic, then your only chance is to kill them. It's the only hope. If you really believe that the opposition is so psychotic that nothing will stop them from killing people ever, you have to kill them all. Or you have to agree with the point that I think the Confederacy was founded on, which is that the man who's trying to kill you has reasons, or at least thinks he does, and he has family, and he has concerns. He has things that he values. He values some things more than he values his own life, obviously, because he's willing to go and expose himself to great danger to get what he wants. You need to find out what those things are, and you need to create an environment where he can believe that your intercession could be beneficial to him. So we're starting with that. So the first rule of power, your power to deal with your enemy, comes from your capacity to believe in his humanity. To the extent that you can believe in it, you can do something other than trying to kill him. Otherwise, you're powerless. You're just absolutely powerless. If you believe that you can't deal with him and there's no way to deal with him, then you have no power except to kill him. And of course, if you can't kill him, then where are you?
Our thanks to Professors John Mohawk and Orrin Lyons, both of the American Studies Department at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Special thanks as well to Deborah Kolodzak and Joyce Kryzak for production assistance. Our engineer and producer is Paul Ingalls. To hear this program again and for more about the great law of peace of the Six Nations of the Iroquois, visit our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's where you can hear all the programs in our series and also where you can make your financial contribution to keep Peace Talks on the air during our annual fund drive, Now in Progress. Peace Talks is a production of Good Radio Shows Incorporated, a nonprofit media organization producing programs meant to inform, inspire, and improve the human condition. Additional support from KUNM, the McCune Charitable Foundation of New Mexico, and the Peace Tales CD Project. I'm Carol Boss. Thanks for listening.